Hello everybody, James here, Ask Dutch Anything, and we'll be asking, as the name says, Dutch anything that you want. Now, for this episode, we are going to be going back through the archives of questions and asking some of the best questions from you that we may have missed or didn't get to for time constraint reasons. So, we've got, I don't know, about 15.
How did you miss these questions, James?
We get so many questions in that we can't get them all. So what I do is I've got like a Word file. Have I told you this, Dutch?
No, you haven't. This is a first for me too.
Yeah, I've got like a docs file with every question we've been sent. And it's about 150 pages long.
No.
Yeah. I promise you it's that long. We've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of questions backed up. So because when we were doing occasional fan question episodes here and there, we didn't get to them all. And then when we started doing the Ask Dutch Anything episodes like this one is right now, I thought, well, great, we'll finally get through the backlog. No, just more people messaged. So now we're getting dozens and dozens every week. And we can never, ever get back. We can't get to them all. So I thought we'd go for this one, back through the archives and pick some of the best ones.
Okay. Let's go.
You've got two books behind you.
I'm going to be honest. Some of these things go so far back, I don't even remember them. So that's why, you know, you send me a preview of what we're going to talk about. And I found myself today said, wait a minute. Let me research that. Then I go back. Then I remember it. Hmm. Or some of it anyway. And if I just don't remember it, I might as well tell you, I don't remember. Yes, these are my two books.
It's gone the other way. There you go.
There we go. Tales from a Dirt Road and The World According to Dutch. Autographed copies are for purchase. Just email me at dirtydutchmantel with how many L's, James?
Two.
Two L's at gmail.com. And ask me the information, and I'll send it right to you. I may be a half a day late or so, but I'll get it to you. And, you know, all the reviews that I got on these books, the lowest one was about a 4-star, maybe a 3.5-star. That's the lowest one out of probably, I guess I've gotten 500 reviews on it. But the lowest one is about 3.5, and most of them are 4.5 to 5. Because I tell a story like I talk. Jim Cornette told me one time, he says, he read the book, he said, when I'm reading the book, I'm reading it in your voice. And that's how I read it. And Stone Cold Steve Austin, he got the books, and he said, son of a bitch. I said, what? He says, I wanted to go to sleep last night. And I started reading your book and read it all the way through. I couldn't put it down because the books, the chapters don't connect. It's just one incident here and what happened over here and what happened over there. And it's all just discombobulated into one big book. And sometimes that's the way I figure my wrestling career has gone, because it's all of a sudden they are vast amounts of time that I don't remember. And if I really think hard, I can remember it. Unless something important was going on. And I don't know. Do you find that true, James? Mm. If nothing important was going on, you don't remember it much?
Yeah, I don't remember yesterday. I'm almost problematic. I'm like a goldfish. I remember nothing.
So I'm normal.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
But anyway, write me at dirtydustmantel with two L's at gmail.com. And you can get the books. Also, the University of Dutch diploma, which is actually moving right now for some reason. You know, if you have something, you know, that the fans can get, and you'll have hot spells and you'll have slow down spells. But the University of Dutch, with the president, Dirty Dutch Mantel, and the provost, Zeb Coulter, they both signed it. So you get two autographs and a university degree, and write me at that email address, dirtydutchmantel with two L's at gmail.com, and I'll get back to you on it. All right, so let's get some questions here.
Oh, hang on. I've got two books as well. I've got two books, in fact, that if you order them right now, they'll be there in time for Christmas. I'm very much sure of that. On Amazon, both of them, Owen Hart, King of Pranks, What I Wrote, and The Rock, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, the People's Champion, from WWE to Hollywood. That's the name of my book. I remembered. And of all the reviews, I've got many, many 5 stars, a couple of 4 stars, and one idiot gave me a 2-star review saying it would only appeal to wrestling fans. It's about a wrestler, clown. Of course it's supposed to appeal to wrestling fans.
No kidding.
Jesus.
I regretted writing that after I wrote it.
I know.
I'm going to go back. And I'm going to take it down.
Hey, you can keep the review. Just give me at least 4 stars, for goodness sake. Bring the average up.
I will do that.
Wait
a minute. So, you know, we got some news lately.
Did we?
Impact is going back to their former name, TNA.
Dutch, I need to stress at this point that this is not going to be shown this week. This is going to be shown in December. So this will be incredibly old news.
Incredibly old news.
Yes.
It is. Okay.
No, I promise you, so we're keeping this evergreen for now, but for now, we will refer to that news in a later episode that will come out earlier, if you know what I mean.
Okay, so would this be edited out?
Nah.
No.
No.
Nah. Okay.
Let us do fan questions. And as I said before, these are from the archive somewhat, so if you're really, really surprised to hear your question being read out months in advance, well, hey, you know, it's your lucky day. And the first one is Tim Strines. Did Spike Dudley have a death wish? Thank you.
Spike Dudley is legendary for the punishment he took at the hands of everybody, mostly the Dudley brothers. Devon and Bubba Ray. And he joins two other guys that became famous because of they were enhancement talent totally. And later on, they tried to do something with Spike. But the Monkey Brothers also, they were WCW enhancement talents. And they got the the dog shit beat out of them. I mean, and it was hard sometimes. I'd be sitting back in the dressing room with the monitor on, and we'd see a move, we'd go, God. But he'd always get up. Even the Monkey Brothers, they would always get up. So, if nothing else, I think Spike had the respect of the fans. The Monkees also had the respect of the fans because everybody knew what they were doing. They would take those sometimes power bombs on the concrete floor. And it was hard to watch it. And I got to thinking, guys, you know, you don't really need to do that because when you get about 40, 35 to 40, your back is going to look at you and just say, why? Why did you do that? But they enjoyed doing it. I think they had some kind of not a death wish, but a pain wish. And I would like to talk to them now and see how their backs or elbows or knees or shoulders even head, see if they got any mental difficulties from doing all that stuff, because they can't be 100% healthy and moving around, but they get my respect as they got all wrestling fans' respect.
Sticking with Spike, what was the stupidest thing or the most reckless thing you ever saw him do to his own body?
I try not to watch it.
Would he come to you and say, listen, I'm thinking of doing this in our match?
No. And I didn't want him to. Because if he'd come to me, I said, brother, isn't there something else that you can do, like acting hurt? If you take a big clothesline, just act like it killed you. I mean, the only person that knows it hurts is you. So I want you to sell me and the fans that it was very, very painful. And we can see it's, you know, concrete doesn't give. A tile floor doesn't give. So now a ring will give. We can see that because everybody takes a bump in a ring. But on that concrete floor, nope, it's not happening. No, he would never come to me, nor did I want him to. Because most of the time I wasn't in the same company as Spike. I was in the same company with the Mokey brothers. They never asked. So, and I never contributed any ideas. What I should have said, listen, why don't you go outside, get on the roof of the building and have them throw you off into a burning table like that. And it looked like as those spots went on, and now you can still see those spots. I mean, they still make them up on these little independent shows. See how far they can get with a burning table or tacks on a burning table or glass on a burning. I don't get it. See, I wasn't taught that way. Wrestling, I was taught, hey, tell the story and everybody gets it. And everybody gets the burning table too. But you don't get up and keep wrestling. That's what they do. They'll take this hellacious move off of really a one-story building and then get up and continue. To me, that's stretching it just a little too far. But anyway, Spike, you have my respect, as do the Mokey brothers.
I was just looking at his matches there. He really didn't make that many appearances in TNA. Quite a few in 2006 and then very sporadic. Just very briefly, once again on Spike, any personal stories with him? I've heard he's very, very, very nice chap.
Oh, he is. That's the only interaction I had with Spike. It's giving him what's going to go on in the match as the agent of the match. See, all the agent has to do is give the necessary information. You got 3 minutes or you got 4 minutes. And we need to get in and we need to get out. And with Spike in the match, unless you had something important, you know, we'd be taking it on Spike. Of course, the Dudleys were his sponsors anyway. And he'd be probably in a match with them, either tagging with them or they had a little problem and they were facing him. And I would leave it with them and I'd just go away. And I would come back right before the match. And I said, you got it, guys? Got it. When Bubba told me he got it, he got it. So I took his word for it.
Next question, although it might actually be a series of questions here, sticking on the theme of TNA. Carlos from Madrid has sent us, I don't know if it's his own personal list of top 10 funny moments from TNA or from another website that's compiled this list, but I've named a few of them, and you can pick whichever one that you want to talk about. James Storm and Chris Harris wrestling in blindfolds. Sting disguising himself as Sting. Mm-hmm. Shark Boy and Curry Man versus Team 3D. Mm-hmm. Kurt Angle's Thanksgiving dinner and also Kurt beating the hell out of Santa Claus and making a little girl cry. Number three was Christy Hemme versus Big Fat Oily Guy in a tuxedo match. And that's all the ones that I've listed because I think we've talked about the other ones before. But of all the ones I've just said there, do you have any sort of inside story into any of them?
The Kurt Angle Thanksgiving dinner. Was it Thanksgiving dinner?
It was.
Yeah. Thanksgiving dinner. And I remembered it, but I didn't remember it. So I went back and I researched. James, I took a page out of your book.
Crikey.
I went back and actually researched it. And I had forgotten we'd even done that. And in watching it back, it was great entertainment because you bring a lot of people out. You expose a lot of people. And it started with Kurt and his then wife, Karen, who is now married to Jeff Jarrett. She was there. She had the pilgrim hat on. And AJ Styles was there and Jeremy Borash, who was our video guy. He was there. Then James Storm was there. Eric Young came out. And some more talent came out. They was probably at least 14 or 15 guys there around the table. And I remember Kurt telling everybody to take their hats off. And one guy says, well, she's not taking her hat on. And she looked like a pilgrim. And he says, she's a pilgrim, you idiot. Which I had to laugh at. But these are the things that you can put on a wrestling show to involve a lot of people. That's kind of not really serious, but it can get serious at the end. You can do something out of it. And this was like a 10-minute segment, and it was actually very, very well done. In good taste, with a little comical side to it, was very, very good. What other, which one else did you name?
Oh, well, just before we get off that, Kurt Angle's, so the Thanksgiving dinner, then Kurt great. Beats the hell out of Santa Claus and makes a little girl cry ringside. So I've not seen this segment at all. So what happened with Kurt making the girl cry?
Well, he beat up Santa Claus. Kurt was a great heel. And he was a great heel just being a little bit comical. Because he was a little bit comical to begin with. And he didn't mind doing it and was great at what he did. So Kurt coming to TNA was a really, really big deal for TNA.
The other one that you mentioned that I want to bring up is Christy Hemme versus Big Fat Oily Guy in a tuxedo match.
Oh, hilarious. That was hilarious. Big Fat Oily Guy was a guy, a big fan, nice guy. But he was, and he will agree with you, I'm not shaming him because he's fat. But he was fat. And I forgot how they got in this match. But Christy Hemme, they had all that oil and grease on them. And how that match came about, I have no idea. But of course, me being the degenerate I am, I had to go out there and watch the match on TV. And you can imagine it wouldn't go long because Christy Hemme really wasn't a wrestler and Oily Guy wasn't a wrestler. They just put oil all over him. And I even forgot the reason that they even had this match. But I do remember it.
You know, for some reason, TNA, you know, can on occasion say that they were copying WWE. And this is one of the occasions where TNA ripped off WWE because they also had a great big fat guy covered in oil who they called Big Dick Johnson. And for some reason, TNA then came up with Big Fat Oily Guy as a response.
Big Dick Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot believe you said that.
I didn't name him.
I remember that too. See, that's what wrestling does. It will take a name like that and put it on somebody, and it's a little bit blue, but and the adults like nod to each other, but the kids they don't know. Till they're about 10, then they said, "Oh, they call me Big Johnson." Oh my God. But and that's the beauty about wrestling. You can watch it and get the inside scoop.
He mentions one other thing as well, saying top Seb Coulter funny moments. Number one, he puts, this is Carlos from Madrid, Titus O'Neil puking on JBL's hat on SmackDown in 2013 and also pukes on Seb Coulter. Do you remember this?
Oh, yes, I do remember this very plainly, too. I was supposed to run from, they didn't tell me this. And this came directly from Vince. Because I think it was around Thanksgiving. And I remember Tyrus eating and eating and eating some more. And he looked up at me and he didn't even, He said, "Oh man, I think I ate too much. I was at the table." And I said, "Well, man, you gonna be okay?" I don't know. He was telling me, without telling me, that he was going to do something to me out at ringside. And hey, I can't run anymore. Hell, he was a former pro football player, so he had all the speed in the world. I tried to go through the crowd. He caught me. Because by this time, I kind of figured something was up, because they came too aggressively. They came, and what that told me was, whether I ran or not, it didn't matter. They were going to get me. And he got me, and then he threw up. Threw up on the hat, threw up on my shirt, my vest, and my hair. It was horrible.
Was this Shoot's vomit as well? Or was this?
No, it was fake. It was fake vomit. Of course, it was Shoot vomit. What do you mean fake vomit?
I don't know. Maybe you just
how do you go? Can you go to the store and look on the shelf? Fake vomit. You know, of course. Because he didn't do that too much, and he was kind of digging deep to do it. And I got to the back, and everybody was having a laugh. Jack laughed. He knew about it. Everybody knew about it but me. And Vince looked at me and went, "Hey, pal, thanks for not bitching and complaining about that rib yesterday. It was my idea." I went, "Oh, yeah, I didn't say nothing, but what I should have said, oh, yeah, that's funny in hell, Vince. That's a real funny rib." The best told me all the rest of it that I knew. Even, I think it was Swagger. It was Swagger. Swagger, I'll get it right in a minute. It was Swagger knew about it and didn't tell me. So I didn't say nothing, but I'll say this one thing. Vince kind of respected me. You said, "Oh, yeah, right. He got somebody to throw up on. He really respected you." But he did respect me for the years I had put in and the rib and not bitching and complaining and just going along with it. So, but he did say he was sorry. He apologized, but he thought it was they said he was laughing like hell doing the whole deal. So, but that means if they're doing that, they're thinking about you. So, and I kept a job for another 2 years and making good money doing nothing except walking to the ring back and forth. And so I thank Vince for that. I don't thank him for the vomit.
I'm just looking here. You may have got off lighter than Michael Cole because Titus puked in JBL's hat and then put it on Michael Cole's head.
Same day?
Same thing, yeah.
Well, good. Michael Cole deserved it, though. Michael Cole was talking one day, and I'm at it ringside. Something come up about Puerto Rico, and he says, and Michael Cole says, "But yeah, but that's not a part of the United States, brother." Me and JBL, we jumped him. And then he finally looked it up after the segment went off the air. He didn't even know Puerto Rico's relationship with the United States. They're not a state, but they are like a commonwealth. Mm. And we support that island. So he didn't say any more out there when me and JBL was out there trying to, you know, JBL is a hell of a historian. And if you want to know something about history, ask JBL.
Next question. Richard has asked, did you have any experiences of possibly the most terrifying manager in real life, memories of Homer Odell?
Very, very little. Never met the guy.
Really?
Never met him. He was never in a place where I was.
Moving right on then. A Mark. Now, this is, guys actually just call himself a Mark.
A Mark.
Hey, Mark. Howdy, James and Dutch Coulter. He's decided to say, curious, do you have any interesting stories about Nick Bockwinkel? And where do you rank him in the pantheon of legendary wrestling champions? Also, do you think Nick Bockwinkel could find success in modern day wrestling? I always thought MJF was very similar to Nick. What do you think?
Nick, great champion, great worker, and you have to consider the style. The Minnesota style was a wrestling style. Actually, to me, I always thought it was boring. I really did. Guys would go out there, but that's the way they educated their fans. Nick was a wrestling champion. Bobby Heenan was actually very entertaining. He was probably the best. He was the most entertaining on the show. And Nick, could he get over today? Yeah, he probably could get over today. Nick was a pretty good sized guy, great talker. But it's according to how they present him. It's like anything else. It's according to how they present him, who his opponents are, what they did with him. A lot of things go into that. Can so-and-so get over? Hell, big, fat, oily guy could get over for a while if you just did the right thing with him, but not for long term. And I don't rate Nick Bockwinkle up there with that lying Ric Flair. And drawing the money, I don't rate him up there with Hulk Hogan or Stone Cold Steve Austin or The Rock. That's probably my Mount Rushmore of wrestling. But I would have to actually, I think, put another face on that whole mountain. And you'd have to add Vince McMahon. Because without Vince McMahon, who knows what or if the WWF would have ever been created. I don't think so. Without him. So my top four, and I'll put Vince in there, make it a top five.
How often did Nick come to Memphis?
He would come once a year, maybe. And of course, he'd only wrestle Lawler. But that was the beauty about Memphis. Sometimes they would bring in guys like Nick Bockwinkle, and it would be a big deal, because they would have video on him, and he would send interviews in. And why it drew is because they made it appear important, because he was the AWA champion. And he would come in, and sometimes he would only come in if he didn't put the title up. That told you that Lawler was going to beat him. When he put the title up, no, Lawler would lose by a Jimmy Hart interference. But he would also bring in Terry Funk, Dory Funk, and he would bring in stars or other talent from other territories that you would never see in Memphis full time. So this was your chance to see them. And then he would come in on Memphis on a Monday. And then the next week he would come back to Memphis for a rematch. But he would also end up going to Louisville, Evansville, and maybe Nashville, or Lexington, Kentucky. Those were the big towns, drawing towns in the territory, and he'd make an appearance there. So one time I went to Lexington, Kentucky, and I can't remember what the main event was. And it's Rupp Arena in Lexington, Kentucky. And they built it's 20,000 seats. You know, 20,000 seat arena in a town like Lexington, Kentucky is a pretty big arena, but they did it because they had a basketball team that was used to be in the top four every year almost. So they would fill that Rupp Arena up. Basketball was huge, huge in Kentucky. So we would go in there once a month, and we wouldn't put 20,000 people in there, but we would section. They would section it off. We would have half arena, but it would be full. it'd probably be 9 or 8, 9, 10,000 people in there, and very, very loud. You know, some arenas are just allowed, just loud because of the fans. That they love wrestling there, and it was a great place, a great place to have a wrestling match. So,
was Nick a guaranteed sellout when he came in?
He wasn't a guaranteed sellout, but he was a guaranteed really, really good house. And what? He only probably worked with Lawler and maybe Handsome Jimmy. He may have done that, but he was always good for a good house.
Was the
against a good opponent.
Was the AWA world title seen as important as the NWA world title in the Tennessee area?
I don't think they used the NWA world title.
Well, that's sort of what I'm getting at. I mean, they really did. They had Ric Flair in once as NWA champion, then he never came back. But, I mean, people got the magazines. They mustn't. They would have known what the NWA title was. But as far as that goes, was the AWA title held in as high esteem as the NWA or WWF at the time?
You know, James, I never actually went out and took her.
I know.
I put a questionnaire out. Who do you think is more important, AWA or NWA? I think it was a title match, and they didn't see Bockwinkel that much, and he presented himself well. I think Flair, the NWA title, meant more because you could get that, you know, Channel 17 feed all across the country. So the NWA title had more advertising behind it, more push behind it than anything else. So I would have to say no.
So our next question is from Jeff. He says, just watched a clip from Florida in November 1984 where Jim Neidhart talks to Gordon Solie about his amateur accomplishments, and the Anvil delves into how the American athletes should be subsidized and treated like Russian athletes. Dutch comes out to confront Neidhart and starts a fight at Gordon's desk. Dutch then says he's angry because of his experiences in Vietnam and runs down Neidhart's teammates Crusher Khrushchev and the Saint with a patriotic promo. The question is, did Dutch bring Neidhart to Florida with this idea specifically, or did the real-life experiences of you both conveniently make it a no-brainer story to tell?
Well, when I got to Florida, I think Neidhart was there. His partner was there. I forgot what his partner was named. And the Saint, who is Fidel Sierra or something, he's a popular guy around Tampa, he was under the mask. So those characters were already in place. So when he comes out, Neidhart comes out, and he's bad-mouthing the U.S., and keep in mind that when I took it over down there, it was dead. It was deader than Kelsey's nuts, which always brings up the question, who was Kelsey and why was his nuts dead? Mm-hmm. I've always asked that question. But Dusty had just left and to go to Mid-Atlantic. We call it Charlotte. We called it Charlotte in those days. And he took everybody who was anybody with him. He took Magnum T.A., took him. He took Barry Windham. He took him. He took them all. So what I inherited down there was a half a company, because the people they had been used to following on Florida Championship Wrestling were gone. So when I came in, I was building from ground zero. There was nobody over. I was probably the most over guy, and I hadn't been there in 4 years. Well, not really. So, and I took what I had. You know, old saying in sports, you take what they give you. It's like in football. If they're going to give you a loose pass defense on the left side, well, take what they're offering you and see what you can get out of it. So, and when I did this angle with Neidhart, I think it was an Eddie Graham idea at the time, because I had just started. So he was helping me out. Or it could have been a Dory Funk was a, the previous booker before me. And business wasn't bad, but I mean, he took over from Dusty. And then when Dusty left, and then when business went down, Dory said, I'm getting out of here. I don't feel like doing this. And that's where I entered. But I got my first booking experience in Florida. And I've been asked the question, how did you get the job? Well, I got it through Jerry Jarrett, because all the promoters back in those days would talk to each other. How you doing? What's this? What's that? You got any good baby faces? You got any good heels? What angles are you doing? They all talked with each other. And Jerry told him, he said, I got a guy here that I think you may be interested in. And he knew who I was. And how is he? He says, well, never been really tried before, but I think he's watched enough and learned enough that he can go and do it. So I went down there and I took what it gave me. And eventually it started coming up a little more and coming up a little more and coming up a little more. But when you talk about that period, I know we want to talk about Jim Neidhart here, but all that was given to me. Eddie, I think around, I forgot the date Eddie killed himself.
It was the Super Bowl, wasn't it, around there?
Yeah, it was the Super Bowl 1985, I think. I'm pretty sure. He killed himself on that day because we were in Orlando. And Orlando used to run at the Eddie Graham Sports Stadium. It used to run every Sunday night. But during the Super Bowl was on that night, so we ran that afternoon. And it wasn't that bad, really, considering changing the time. You have a date on it?
No. No, it was definitely January 85, though, I think.
Yeah, it had to be for the Super Bowl. And that's when I heard that Eddie Graham had shot himself. And you talk about it just, I mean, the atmosphere, and then it spread out into the crowd. Before the show was over, about the last match was on, the crowd had started hearing about it. And you talk about a gloomy, dismal situation it was. So we left and I went back to Tampa where I was living and made a few calls, and then I found out they said he was dead, but he wasn't dead. He was on life support and he shot himself not once but twice and still didn't finish the job, so they pulled the plug the next day. And after that, I just lost my enthusiasm for Florida. I lost my, the love for what I was doing. I just didn't want to do it anymore. It was like, and Eddie helped me a lot. He would sit down and he would talk about building blocks, how you build a guy and how you build another guy at the same time. And it sounds a little complicated, but it's really not. But one thing he told me, and I've always made use of, is listen to your audience. They will tell you who to spend time on. And so I've always done that, and I've always been successful. So thank you, Eddie. You helped me a lot. And the thing about Eddie is his grandson killed himself, and then his son killed himself. So when you talk about suicide in wrestling, I mean, I don't think the Graham family has to be the number one story, because I've really never, I may have heard of that, but I've never heard of it in wrestling. So sad story, very sad story.
With Jeff's question, what was Jim Neidhart like to work with? Did you work with him nightly, or did you even get that far?
No, I worked with him. I was working with him up to that point. He was okay. He was a little anxious, a little nervous, because I can see that he wants to do well, and he was a football player and had a lot of energy. He had that. But he didn't go in business for himself. He was a team player. He worked with the team. He worked with his opponents. And actually very believable. If you put a camera in his face when he's talking, and I guess he learned that from Stu and from the Harts, because he's a brother-in-law, correct or no?
He is, yeah, but I'm not sure he got any of his promo skills from the Harts.
No. He had to get that from himself, but he knew what he was supposed to do to get attention on himself. And actually, he got over in Florida a little bit.
Next question. Percy Smith, with everything we know about him now, can you tell us your opinions on Grizzly Smith as a worker, backstage road agent, and his private life?
Grizzly Smith, I saw him actually when I was a kid, when I was growing up, and he was a member of the Kentuckians. It was a big, just two big guys. It was Jake Smith, and I forgot who the other guy was. And they were just like mountain guys who found a wrestling ring, and they would go in there, and they were big guys. Grizzly Smith was about 6'9", maybe a little taller, but I guess in that world, he was like kind of like a giant, but he wore big overalls. So you knew his wrestling ability inside the ring didn't have to be great, and it was never great. All they would do is push and tug and throw punches and kicks. That's all they would do. And they had a long run with a team called later they were called the Assassins. I forgot what their names were then, but it was the same deal. It was a masked team, and it was Tom Ernesto and Jody Hamilton, and they had a long run in mid-Atlantic with that team. Now, we're bringing up his ability to work on a scale of 1 to 10 was about a 4, because he didn't have to work. That wasn't his gimmick. Now, if he was a 10, I mean, he'd be a totally different gimmick. But to cover all that up, that's why they made him look like we call it a mountain hooger. I think that's what we call him. But or I did. Now, as far as his personal life, I think Jake had a lot of demons. He had a lot. So if you read the history of the family, and Jake the Snake has even put this out, and the daughter has put this out, that he molested the daughter, and he traveled. He liked young girls, really young girls. And so you can't speak highly of a man who does things like that, but yet he claimed to be a Christian. I've seen him carrying the Bible around. So go figure. So he never did anything bad to me. I just heard stories. Basically, I kept my distance from him. And he was the agent when I was in Mid-South, because he was an old friend of Bill Watts. And if you ask the question, did Bill Watts know what he was doing? I have no idea. But I think if he did, I think Bill would have gotten rid of him. I didn't think he would want to be involved with somebody like that. I think the young girl had a child by Grizzly, or so I've read. I may be wrong, but there was a lot of talk about Grizzly. Not so much then, but I learned all this later. So.
Two more things that I was just going to pick up on. So rumors at the time, there weren't really many rumors flying around about Grizzly at the time.
No, they were rumors, but again, I go back to my stay in my lane. I didn't investigate it, and nobody I knew was involved in it. So that was my slant on it.
And very similarly, because you mentioned he was a WCW agent, what did agents do in WCW at the time? Did they do the same things as in the WWF, or did they do completely different things?
Same thing. See, I had him in Mid-South too. He was the agent. He would go to the town. And what he was the promotions guy in the town. So he would go, whatever the house was, he would pick the money up. I don't think they got to the point they were just writing checks then. You know, a lot of times they would just write a check and deposit the money. I think he actually brought money back from the towns, and he would run the show, and he would make a report how the matches were or what happened or anything Bill Watts needed to know, he would fill him in. Same way with WCW, except he wasn't taking money. They would take the money that came into the box office and they would deposit it in the building's account. Say it's a civic center. The money would go into the civic center's account. Then they would write a check, or I don't know if they did electronic banking back then or not, or they would write a check and Grizzly would bring the check in. And of course, with the number of tickets sold and all this, and they would check that. That's what he did then. Plus, he gave the finishes out, and the same thing in Mid-South. He would say who had a good match, who didn't have, who was late, who got almost got in a fight, any problems, and he'd bring all that back.
Next question. Beef asks, what was it like working with Vince Russo in creative on a daily basis? How many hours would he work in a week in TNA? Would you have formal creative meetings? Who were his most trusted advisors? How many ideas would he pitch on average every day? So a lot to digest there, but for starters, how many hours would he work every day, Vince?
No, well, if we had an 8 hour or a 10 hour creative session, he'd be there doing the whole time. I mean, he wouldn't leave early, he wouldn't do this. Then he would go back to his room wherever he was staying that night. We had the creative session when I was with Vince in Nashville, and he would work on it there. Then we'd come back the second day and see, nothing was really laid down to the second day. We talk it over on Monday and just lay an outline out and then come back and we pick that back up. And then we'd lay the Monday TV out and we would lay the Tuesday TV out. And then we would follow that. I guess either Jeff or Vince booked the active card. Say we were going on tour in 2 weeks and they would write that down. Dependent on what we had done on TV. So we would just follow our TV around. And did he have some good ideas? He probably did, but he pitched about, and I've said this before, and everybody's heard me say this, the worst idea is the one that's not pitched. That could be the one. No, but he pitched a lot of ideas. And sometimes somebody can pitch an idea. Well, as we don't like it, you shit can it. And then 2 days later, the idea could come back, but this time we have a different reference in mind, a different frame. We may like it. So it's according to how it affected the group. It was me, Jeff, and Vince. And Vince would throw something, I would throw something. And Jeff, since he was a part owner, he would have the third round and he would throw something. Then we would go around again and I would say, well, I thought my idea was best. Vince would do the same thing. And then Jeff, we'd let him make the decision. So, and that's the way it went around. Not all ideas are going to sell out. Some ideas are produced just to get a title over or to get an angle over or to get a frame of reference over. These matches are different things for different areas of the card. say if you have a first match and a second match, if you're not going to do anything with the guys in the first match, just let them have a match, a good, solid match. Put one of them over. Doesn't matter. I mean, if the heel goes over, it's kind of a flat ending, but and put the baby face over and let's run. And we have seen a lot of times, say, Sami Zayn, how many times did he lose? He lost and he lost and he lost and he lost some more. And when he went to the ring, he's going to lose. And how long now was, how long will it take him to lose? But he got over, because when he finally started telling his story, you kind of felt sorry for him and you want him to do better. I'm talking about a fan's mind and a fan's heart. And he's likable anyway. So when he started doing better, he said, wow, perseverance, it paid off. He stayed with the course. He didn't let the losses bother him. And people wanted to see him do good. So when he finally got his shot at Roman Reigns, and what town is he from in Canada?
Toronto? Montreal or Quebec or something like that. Yeah.
Montreal. The people were falling out of the seats because he was them. And when they would look at him, they would see themselves, or they would see their family, or they would see a friend. But basically, they saw a Canadian who was doing well, and they wanted to support him. So, and a lot of people said, well, they should have put Sami Zayn over that point. Well, for the house, yes. I mean, the roof would have come off. But then you got to figure out after Roman lost to Sami, now what are you going to do with Roman? So you can't take a project that you've spent 3 years building and all of a sudden just on a whim, just because the crowd is going to pop huge. You can't stake your future on that. So they didn't. They did the right thing there. And Sami Zayn is still over today. I think they need to go back to him a little more, but I think he's money in the bank for him.
With the Vince Russo question, you answered most of it, but one thing was, who are his most trusted advisors or collaborators or whatever, at least in TNA?
I mean, collaborators. That sounds like a World War II, some kind of spy film.
No, it's not like an Axis of Evil kind of thing I was getting at.
And who was the most trusted?
Well, no, who was Vince Russo's most trusted writer or writers or bookers that he would work with and basically take their opinion, or whose opinion was most like Vince Russo's as well?
Well, Vince's opinion is out there sometimes. It's you look at him and you say, you can't be serious. But he is serious, because he looks at wrestling different. My job and Jeff's job at the same time was to, Vince was wide open. He was 8 cylinders the whole time. My job was to take that power out of the 8 cylinder and try to frame it down to where it had the same power with 4 cylinders. And Jeff did the same thing. And he had the, and I think he'll agree with it, he wanted it right now. He don't want it 2 weeks. He don't want it next week. He wants it right now. So he had a tendency to get ahead of schedule when he was booking stuff. And my job was to rein him back in. But to rein somebody in is not necessarily a disagreement. You know, I would say, wouldn't it be better? Because you get more with, you know, sugar than you do with vinegar. You say, let's rein this back in, because at this point, I think you're like 2 weeks ahead. See, he would have a match, two guys would fight outside the ring. Next week, he wants to come back, set up a no DQ match. He puts it in a cage. Well, you're 1 week ahead already, at least maybe 2 weeks ahead of it. You don't need a cage. They just fought outside on the floor. I mean, that's the intricacies you go in building the angle. They fight outside, then they do it again, then screw this shit. We're going to put them in a cage and this, that, and the other. And you work it to a point to where maybe somebody gets in, then you put, say, barbed wire on the top to keep them out. But you can only go so far with that angle. I mean, it has only so many arms and tentacles you can go from. Then you have to put somebody over. And I had no problem putting the baby face over because I would get out of that program. Babyface got beat. There's another babyface in there. But the babyface that got beat, guess what? He didn't forget. And he can come back at any time and beat the hell out of that heel. Then that heel brings, it's just, it's here or, you know, bring the people in they know, people in you think they would be interested in seeing, and you take it from there. Vince always got ahead of himself.
We've got time for two or three more. We'll see how we go with this one. Next.
That folks, that means like 10.
Yeah. 10 more. We've got time for about 10 more.
10 more.
Francis
Morris. You know, people write me and tell me that they go on trips. A lot of truck drivers, you know, write me and say, and I don't know how they watch the screen. They drive the truck, guys, drive the truck.
Not like acid trips then.
No, I don't think so. But but they enjoy the show, and I guess they do because that's what it's for. This is not for me and James. It's just for fans who love professional wrestling, which is what we do, and we can find fault in it. But still, we know there's a ton of people out there who enjoy talking wrestling and watching TV and watching us. Mm-hmm. So continue, James.
Our next question is from Francis Morris. Do you have any stories on Gorilla Monsoon when you worked for the WWF in the mid-90s?
Well, I don't have any stories per se about him. I do have some stories about him when he was in Puerto Rico because I didn't know this till much, much later after the Bruiser Brody incident. I found out that Gorilla Monsoon owned points in that promotion. I didn't know that. So one night I'm sitting in the dugout. Gorilla Monsoon is sitting right there, and he's white. He had a big cigar. He's sitting there, and we're watching the matches. And he's a friendly enough guy, but I didn't know that he was one of the owners. And I don't think I said anything bad. I may have about the booker that was in the ring at the time. But if I'd have known that, I would try to have gotten to know Gorilla Monsoon a little better. I knew, and he also had points in the old WWWF. He had points in there. So, and talking about the Brody incident, I did some more research on it, and what I think was the root cause of the incident that night was that Bruiser Brody was going to pick up the percentage points that Gorilla Monsoon had in Puerto Rico because, you know, he had enough to do working for Vince McMahon Sr., Vince McMahon Jr., and so he wanted to get rid of his points in Puerto Rico. Brody, I think, it's uncorroborated, of course, but I think he was going to pick up the points that Gorilla Monsoon had. Now, how do I know that? Because Victor Quiñones, who eventually started another company in Puerto Rico, he knew Gorilla Monsoon from New York or Boston. He knew him up there. Knew him since he was a kid. And he was a good friend to Brody and a good friend to Gorilla Monsoon. So, and whether that's true or not, I don't know, but knowing these guys, like, I don't know them well, but I think that would be a fair example of what was going to happen. And changing the points, and I've talked about this before, didn't sit well with some people already in that office, and it caused a lot of hard feelings. Mm-hmm. And that resulted in Bruiser Brody's death.
With that being said, so obviously you did share the WWF with Gorilla Monsoon in the mid-90s. Was he just not there very much at that point?
I didn't have, he was an announcer. Let me say that. I never really ran across him that much. He was there. He was there at TV, and he was there maybe in the production truck. But as far as him coming through and saying hello to everybody and talking things, he never came through. I mean, he knew who I was. I knew who he was. But, no, I never got to know him personally. I knew his son.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you mean Joey Morella or Victor?
Yeah. Victor's not his son. But they say he's his son.
Well, that's what I was going to say. There's many rumors that he was his son.
Yeah, there's a lot of rumors that Victor Quiñones was the illegitimate son of Gorilla Monsoon. Now, illegitimate means, well, he was not married to the woman, not to the mother.
Out of wedlock.
That's it. But Joey was his legitimate son.
No, he was adopted, Joey. As well, he was his legitimate son, but yeah, Joey was his adopted son.
So he's not genetically his son.
No.
Does he have any genetical, real kids? Or no?
Depends.
Do you know?
It depends if Victor's his kid. I don't know. As best I know, Joey was adopted, and he died in 1994 in a car wreck.
Yeah.
With Downtown Bruno. Harvey Whippleman was in the car with him.
I didn't know that either. I may have known it, but I didn't realize it. Yeah. I talked to Harvey not too long ago. So,
well,
he wants to come on the show.
Yeah, you've told me he wants to do it really late in the evening. Which, late in the evening.
He has a thing called a job. Who wants a job? No, but he says he has a thing, has a job, takes up his mornings. So, but he's a funny son of a gun. He really is. I really like him. Did you know The Rock bought him a truck?
Yep.
And you know why?
Didn't he put him up in his house at one point?
Yes, he did, because The Rock hasn't always been a billionaire or a millionaire. He started around Nashville, Tennessee, which is where a lot of guys start. You don't make any money much, make a living. Some of them do. And when he was really having some hard times, Downtown Bruno said, "Hey, man, you can sleep in my room. Are you sure? Yeah, come on in." And he says he's, I don't know how long he stayed there. And even The Rock will say this, Bruno had no, he just did it. He didn't expect anything in return. He just did it because he was a good guy helping out another guy. Said he didn't even really know him that well. But Bruno could see he was having a hard time and offered him a place to stay, and he took it. But on Rock's behalf, he didn't forget that. So later on, he was in Nashville, I think, and he got in touch with Bruno, and they went somewhere, and they walked up to a truck, and Rock says, "Hey, I like my truck." He said, "Oh, wow, man, that's a great truck. That's really nice-looking truck." He said, "You want to drive it?" He said, "Oh, I don't want to drive it." He said, no, drive it. So he got in there, and Brock got on the other side, and they drove it around a little bit. And then he told him, he says, "Hey, truck's not mine." He said, "Whose is it?" He says, "It's yours." And handed him the keys and the papers to it. And Bruno, I know Bruno, he's very emotional. And he broke down, he started crying. This is on tape somewhere. But if anybody deserves a gift like that, it is Bruno. Because in his heart, he's really, really a good guy. And Rock never forgot it. So, I mean, people like that, you just got to admire. He didn't have to do anything for Bruno but thank him. But he bought him like a $35,000 truck. That's a pretty sizable, substantial gift, I would say. Mm-hmm. So, but that's the story.
Would it be funny if Rock said, "How do you like my truck?" And Harvey went, "Oh, it sucks. Who gave you that? Piece of shit."
Yeah. Yeah. Wouldn't be. That would be. I think The Rock knew they were filming it, but Bruno didn't. What if he said he gave it me? That's how you like that truck. It's a nice truck. Here, it's yours. I don't want that piece of shit. What? I just got to put gas in it and do that stuff. I don't know. But actually, when Rock was growing up, I may have told you this. We lived in the same hotel. He lived two doors down from me, Rocky Johnson, and his name was Dewey. That was his name, Dewey. And he used to go out, and I would look off my balcony. I'd see him. They like had a swing set down there. He'd be on the swings, his mama with him, and you know. But I never thought Rock would end up being what he was doing. And now Rocky's already passed on. The mother's still alive. Very, very nice lady. And I bet I met her maybe twice, maybe. And she lived right down the hall. And the reason I didn't meet her more was because I didn't want to act like, you know, I'm just bothering her all the time. So she had things to do. But anyway, Rocky Johnson still owes me, you know, a cloth overhead in a car.
Yeah.
So he was smoking a cigar one day and done like this and burnt my cloth top. You know, I don't know what you call that. And he says, "I'll get you another one." And I never got my other cloth. So even when I traded the car, it had a big cigar burn in it. Because nobody looked at it, I guess. So, but that's one of the things, you know, happens and it just goes by.
I'm going to ask you one more question, then we will shut it down. I'll limit it to one. No name given for this says, after WWE banned unprotected chair shots to the head in the wake of the Chris Benoit murders, they pretty much disappeared from the mainstream wrestling landscape. Is this a good thing, or is this throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and can chair shots to the head still be done safely without causing lasting damage to the receiver? And also, what is the best way to take a chair shot and the worst way?
There's no name given.
Yep.
Now, we don't know who wrote this question. Vince McMahon could have wrote this question.
Could have been a celebrity, yeah.
Oh, yeah, or whoever, or Triple H, he could have wrote it. Okay, what's that last question? What did he say that – what was the middle part of that question?
Is banning of chair shots to the head a good thing, or is it throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and can chair shots be delivered to the head safely?
Okay. Well, can be. The safety part is this. Oh, God, don't hit me. That's the safe way. Guys, and I look at Mick Foley with this. Mick Foley had The Rock. We were just talking about The Rock. He had him blast him with his hands behind his head, handcuffed, hands behind his back. And he was handcuffed. And then he had his little daughter or son watching it. And I'm thinking, why would you do that? I mean, they're thinking it's real. You're crying. The guy's hitting you. I don't know if that did any psychological damage to those kids or not, but I wouldn't have done it in front of my daughter at all. And yeah, people who throw those chair shots just wild or crazy. I'm not taking them. I've been in some matches, like a hardcore match, and I said, and I would tell the guy, I said, "I'm not doing a hardcore match, independent show." He said, "Well, that's what it's advertised at." I said, "I told you when you booked me, don't put me in a hardcore match. I'm not doing it." "Well, why not?" I said, "First of all, I don't know you, Madam's House Cat. I don't know how you work, and I am not." See, when you're in a ring with a guy and he picks up a chair, you're expecting him not to take your head off. But what if you don't know him? And what if he just all of a sudden just really looked tough in front of his friends and he just rips your head off? Well, that may be good for his image. It's not good for your head. You're only going to take so many shots on that head before it begins to tell on you.
How many weapon shots have you taken to the head over your career where you didn't put your hands up or didn't get them up in time or something like that?
Well, I put my hands up several times and still it came through. The hardest I've ever been hit was by Tommy Dreamer. Brother, I got that chair away from him and I didn't hit him back in the head. I hit him across the back. I want him to know that that chair shot did not go unnoticed. So, and then he got up. He said, "I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry." They know what it's for. I mean, you just can't take advantage of somebody like that and knock their head off. And I've had Foley tell me himself, Mick tell me himself that sometimes, and this was years ago, he'll be going somewhere and actually forget how to get there. And then you have to back up and think and then finally backtrack to get back. He said he's done it on the way to his house. So a lot of guys, you don't got to get hit on the head that hard, but just get hit certain ways. I don't like chairs and matches anyway. I mean, I don't like a lot of things about these hardcore matches. Another thing I wouldn't do, thumbtacks. I'm not doing it, period. I can imagine somebody said, okay, I'm going to throw some thumbtacks in there and I'm going to powerbomb you on them. I said, bullshit. You ain't throwing shit out because I ain't doing it. Well, what about some glass? No. What about me throwing fire? No. You're not doing nothing like that because I don't know you. I did have fire thrown at me one time, and I think that was by the Sheik, maybe. But he got about this. I mean, let me see it. He didn't get any closer than that because I was gone. And I think there were some things in wrestling that, I mean, guys could do them and it excited the fans. It didn't excite me. And I'm just not going to do it. So anyway, getting back to the match, I told the guy when he booked me not to put me in a hardcore match. And he said, that's the way it's booked. I said, well, I'll tell you, this is my meeting place in the middle. I said, I'll do the hardcore and you just do the selling. He said, I don't get to use nothing. I said, well, no, because you didn't listen. So he'd get a chair, I'd kick him, take it away from him, hit him. He'd get something else, I'd kick him in the gut and get it and take it away from him. So actually, he won the match and never hit me with anything. He actually won the match with a small package. So, and that's the same night that the one-man gang had that other guy and had him crying. But I enjoyed the night. And if somebody wants to get into wrestling, you know, there's ways to get in. But use your head, guys. I mean, don't climb up on some pole and jump off on some table, because if you want to get hurt, just try that stuff, because it's a damn wonder I'm still walking today. I don't walk good anyway. And a lot of guys that get my age in wrestling, you know, their backs are messed up, their shoulders are messed up, their arms. And it's not, and some of them are messed up because they didn't even do that hardcore of a style. It's just taking those bumps over and over and over and over. So it's a tough business. It really is.
On that note, we shall shut this podcast down. We will see you again next week. As I said at the beginning, I didn't say that at the beginning, actually, questionsfordutch@gmail.com if you want to have your poser answered by the Dutchman himself, the crafty veteran. We have books. You know where they are. They're all links in the description for now, though. Thank you very much for watching. We'll catch you again on Friday. And Dutch, we the people.
We the people.